Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 8 of Tim's Travails, where you're going to meet Chen Wang, CEO of Steel Lake Inc. and the former Deputy Executive Director for Regulatory Affairs for the American Intellectual Property Law Association. So impressive. I can't wait to hear all about it. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and where we also blast out on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts. So take it away, Tim.
Well, thank you, Hope. And first of all, welcome, Chen. So happy to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. Glad you agreed to be on. Yeah, I'm so excited. Thank you for this opportunity.
And, you know, as we kind of exchanged information earlier, there's a broad array of information or topics we could cover. But I think that given we don't want to spend the rest of the whole day on this, we'll try and narrow things down a little bit. But, you know, as I was we were talking prior to starting where we met really when we were both on a committee together. I guess one of the big questions maybe for people to be interested in is how did you get into the whole engineering field, if you will? What got you interested? What propelled you to go in that direction?
Well, thanks so much, Tim. Really, I enjoyed the professional relationship we've had. And I guess we never really talked about this part of my life, how I got into engineering. I actually came to the United States when I was around 8 and a half with my mother and my sister, who was younger than me. And I love math. And, you know, as a immigrant who didn't speak English, math was really a universal language. And I was put in fourth grade because of the language barrier. And of course, I excelled in math like most immigrants from Asian countries, you know, and European countries may be, you know, skilled to do. And that kind of progressed to really loving math in, you know, the rest of my career. My father, who later joined us, from Hong Kong, basically pointed out to me that being a mathematician is a really a hard career. So he suggested that I consider something more tangible. And so as a result, I went into engineering. I actually started with electrical engineering, which is very math intensive, as you may know. And I actually didn't enjoy electrical engineering. I took circuits class. It was the first class I took. And I always did the differential equation around the wrong flow of the circuit. It took me 5 hours to complete a calculation when it took my, you know, classmates an hour. I just couldn't figure out which way was the more efficient way. And being a very efficient person, I basically decided I need to change my focus to something else. And I quickly transitioned to chemical engineering. So I am I don't mind pivoting when, you know, and I quickly assess the situation and I pivot. So I pivoted to chemical engineering and I loved chemistry. It was a lot more understandable. A lot more heuristic. I don't like to memorize things, but when I like something, I don't mind memorizing. And chemistry just made a lot more sense. And chemical engineering, in fact, the education I received at University of Michigan was pretty, I would say, progressive at the time because it was focused on team building and problem solving, which is very open-ended. It wasn't just getting to the right answer. It's getting to an answer that, you know, is actually efficient and solves the problem. Yeah. So a very practical way, very progressive in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And so as a result, you know, I excelled. I really enjoyed engineering school.
And I guess that's how you found your way to DuPont at some point.
Yes. I actually went to law school before I went to DuPont.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
let me step back and ask you the question of what prompted you after doing the whole chemical engineering to then go to law school and put those two things together?
So I was very active in the Society of Women Engineers, SWE, which has a very active student chapter at the University of Michigan, as well as other, you know, engineering schools. And part of that program was promoting high school girls to come into engineering. And I was, we led a summer program as part of SWE to basically bring high school girls who were interested in engineering, maybe not quite sure, to bring in to spend a week at University of Michigan. It was like a summer camp to get to know what engineering is. So one of the programs that I actually organized was, you know, career paths beyond engineering with an engineering degree. And a person that we invited was from Upjohn, which is a pharmaceutical company.
Yeah.
They're part of another Pfizer now, from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And she was a patent attorney that talked about, this is the patent. This is what I do as a patent attorney. And I have an engineering or chemistry background. And that just got me so excited. That was the moment. I mean, literally, I can remember the moment when a light bulb went off in my head and said, this is it. This is what I want to do in life. This is so exciting. I get to learn about new stuff all the time. I don't have to be an expert. I can just ask really stupid questions to help, you know, a real scientist get an invention and get a patent. And that's when I realized I kind of need to go to law school if I want to be a patent lawyer.
and eventually, of course, being a patent person means that you and I ended up knowing a lot of the same people, especially in this town.
Absolutely.
And being on the committee. But how long were you at DuPont then after law school?
So I actually started at a firm in Chicago because I went to Northwestern undergrad. And I know law school, I'm sorry. I met someone who was from DuPont under the Mao statue in Hangzhou, China.
Oh.
Yes. And he recruited me to go to DuPont. That's so Mr. Brinks of Brinks, Hofer, Gilson, and Leone at the time accuses Jim Forstner of stealing me to go to DuPont. And I was there for 18 years.
Oh, wow.
And I knew I wanted to go in-house because before I graduated in 3.5 years from undergrad. And so I had basically 9 months to do something.
Yeah.
You know, I graduated in December and I was very honest with all the recruiters at engineering school. I said, I'm not going to get a full-time job. I'm going to law school. Is there anything for me? And most of them said no. But I got a call one day in December from the chief IP counsel of Dow Corning, who said,
oh, okay.
And, you know, in Midland, Michigan, he said, do you want to come and intern with us? And that's how I got real practical training in patent law at Dow Corning. And so I really realized even before I went to law school that I wanted to go in-house because of that experience at Dow Corning.
Yeah. I mean, there's a huge difference between being at a law firm versus being in the company itself and in the legal department, right? There is a big difference. Yeah.
So. Yeah. What I try to tell people who call me about career options, I feel like the firm environment is like a residency program for med students, right? It's like a pretty intense thing. And you make a decision whether you want to stay in that environment or you want to go in-house.
Yeah.
For me, going in-house meant that I'm closer to the scientists.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot more of the process from, you know, conception to, you know, commercialization to, you know, the whole process of a business. And that's what I really enjoy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but it's not the cup of tea for everyone, right? So you do need to juggle a whole bunch of other things rather than become a focus specialist when you go in-house.
Well, you know, it prompts me to ask a different kind of question here because we both served on a committee as industry advisors to the Department of Commerce and the U.S. Trade Rep. And I guess it prompts the question of how do you think, having been an in-house counsel in patents, how did that help you, let's say, be an advisor to the government with regard to intellectual property trade policy? And maybe is that also helped by the fact that, does being, you know, ethnically Chinese help in that way, or does it matter at all one way or the other? Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's more about the combination of having the chemical engineering legal background and having been in-house is really what allows you to provide the kind of advice you would provide.
That's a great question. I think the in-house perception, it really depends on the person. I was very big picture oriented because of the chemical engineering progressive education I received. It's really focused on problem solving, collaboration with others. And that enabled me within DuPont to not only focus on patents, but I had a pretty involved career beyond intellectual property. I was a business commercial attorney for a number of years. And then I went to mergers and acquisitions, and I actually led quite a number of M&A projects during the whole, toward the latter part of my career.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, I was brought in to do policy work, both intellectual property policy work, international trade policy work within DuPont. And certainly I leveraged my understanding of China as a result of that. You know, I mentioned that I met Jim Forstner, my DuPont recruiter, under the Thatcher and Mao. And that's because I was in China with Brinkshofer, with Mr. Brinks, for business development, where we were actually educating the military. Actually, we gave a presentation in front of the military in the mid-90s. When, you know, they were still trying to figure out what a patent was, and they had the law, but they didn't quite know what it was and things like that. And there was a lot of, you know, efforts in getting them, you know, the China wanting to get into the World Trade Organization and all that stuff. So I was, you know, really quite privileged to have been given an opportunity to help China understand what IP is and how you can leverage IP and what an innovation is and how it interacts with the market economy. And I was, I had, because I was ethnically Chinese, because of the lineage of how I came to my family's history in China, they were very open. The Chinese were very open to my policy explanations. And so that enabled me to form relationships and that kind of progress. So I think my perspective on China was quite unique in the sense that I've had an understanding from the US perspective, especially a Fortune 50 company, multinational, who actually had an office in China during the Qing Dynasty and was very well regarded in China and had trade secrets in China, you know, that it's still maintained a trade secret. So I actually provided, you know, guidance on that as well. So, you know, it's quite unique in that sense, right? So
I would come back and just for the general public and the comment, you know, the comment you made about us educating the Chinese about patents. I think it's worth underscoring this one aside, and that is that, you know, in the 90s and, you know, even early 2000s, I mean, there were a lot of both corporate, U.S. corporate and U.S. government-sponsored programs in many countries where we were trying to educate our trading partners around the world on patents, trademarks, and copyrights. So while, you know, you're talking about your focus there in that moment being China, we have had over the years armies of government lawyers, industry lawyers going to many countries around the world where we were trying to educate our trading partners and people in the government and in the business side on intellectual property. Because as you note, China was about to enter the World Trade Organization. Well, those countries that were already members of the World Trade Organization, they had legal treaty obligations to do things to improve their systems And most of those countries just didn't have the people that had enough knowledge of intellectual property. And so, frankly, the US, the European Union, even Japan, I think, were the leaders in trying to educate people, whether it's South America, Africa, other parts of Asia, in the area of intellectual property. So I don't want people to come away from your comments saying, oh, we focused on China to this, because it was actually a worldwide effort. Yeah. And frankly, it continues even today, because, you know, we have the World Intellectual Property Organization that still does these, some of these most basic levels of education, because so many countries are still lagging behind 30 years after the WTO's treaty.
And that's a very important role that WIPO has in, you know, progressing the infrastructure and understanding of intellectual property. Yeah. Very important.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's also them visiting us as well, right? It wasn't just all of us going out to visit, you know, in the local countries. But as my personal experience was at DuPont, we received a lot of visitors from different countries. And I actually was, you know, designated to be the person receiving the Chinese delegation, which is multiple, from multinationals, you know, state-owned enterprises, as well as from, you know, the governmental entities. European Patent Office sent, you know, delegations to DuPont. I think it visited quite a number of, or you know, organizations, as well as, you know, companies to understand the customer base, right?
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure the USPTO does something similar as well. But
yeah.
It's a lot of exchanges that goes on, and it's all things that, you know, companies do for the reason that we, as a multinational company, you want to see the worldwide IP system to improve, because, you know, your business depends on the strength of IP, and IP is territorial.
So. Right. Well, and I think that's the other part that some people miss, which is, while there's some general commonalities, when you get down to the specifics, every country may have, you know, they have their own little twists and turns and differences, right? So if you're not aware of them, you can make some big mistakes. And given your patents or trademarks, designs, or whatever they may be that you're trying to protect, you may not have fully protected them if you haven't done all the right things in each of the countries that you're going to do business in. So it becomes a pretty monetarily expensive endeavor for multinational companies that have a presence in, say, 50, 60, 100 countries around the world.
So, absolutely. Yeah. So you have to, you know, in this cost-conscious world, you have to know and understand the status of IP protection in the various countries and come up with a strategy based upon your business strategy. And that was actually something that I was also involved in at DuPont. I actually started an IP strategy course at DuPont, where I was teaching the business side, not just the R&D side, but the business side, that you really need to align your business strategy with the IP strategy. So it cannot be a stovepipe situation.
Right. No, absolutely. And, that's interesting, because I don't know that many companies really do what you just described. They all seem to work independent of each other, and not aware of what other parts of the company, what's going on. What is the legal strategy, the intellectual property strategy of the company, versus marketing, branding, and everything else? They can be very separate, and they could be working against each other if they're not careful.
I think, you know, there have been times, in a company's history, not just at DuPont, but a lot of companies' history, where information is power. And so as a result, you know, people don't like to share information. Yeah. I was basically the proponent pushing the businesses to share their strategies, not just among themselves, within themselves, but with R&D, with legal. You know, nobody likes to talk to legal unless they get in trouble, right? And so this was a way of proactively reaching out and saying, look, there's a reason, because IP takes such a long time to acquire and obtain and retain.
Right.
And then there's different forms of IP for different product life cycles. So you really need to think holistically.
Yeah.
And you know, that was you know, something that I did business by business segment, you know, within DuPont. I basically went and conducted courses by business to actually bring the R&D folks and the legal folks and the, you know, the folks from business together in one place to have that level of conversation for, you know, a week, which is a lot of resources, you know, to set aside and focus on IP strategy. But that's what we did for quite a number of years.
So now you've taken all that experience and you're the CEO.
I am the CEO of a startup called Steel-like. Yes, I feel like my entire career prepared me to be where I am today. You know, as Hope indicated, I actually went to AIPOA, which is a professional association of intellectual property law lawyers and agents and other professionals, to focus on actually policy. And my focus was domestic regulatory as well as international policy for IP. And, you know, that was, you know, I was there when my husband invented a new material. And we basically, you know, started, he started, you know, supplying them in 40-pound bags. And one day at the World of Concrete, an entourage showed up and turned out they were from what's called, what, you know, the Kentucky, what is that? Rogers Hollow, basically. where you keep all the gold.
Okay. You're not talking about where they talked at Fort Knox, where they had
Fort Knox. Okay. Thank you. I just had a blip there.
Having lived there, it's easy to remember that.
Yeah, the entourage, an entourage from Fort Knox showed up and said, okay, you have a what's called an ultra high performance concrete. You know, how much can you produce? And my husband proudly said 250 pounds, you know, and our first order was 50 cubic yards, and one cubic yard was 3,600 pounds. So we basically had to scale real quick to basically, and we actually supplied Fort Knox a number of 50 cubic yards, not just one. And then the bridge project started coming, and I said to my husband, you know, we really need to raise some funds because I don't think having a line of credit on our house is going to, you know, be able to supply what we need. So I leveraged all my M&A background to get the company funded. And part of the funding requirement from the investors was that I join full-time as CEO. That's where I am today.
Well, to be clear, when you say Steel-like, it's not steel.
It's not steel. Correct. It is a specialized concrete material that is categorized as ultra high performance concrete. It does not behave like concrete. The biggest particle in UHPC is microns. It's basically smaller than sand. And actually, the biggest particle is sand because there is, you know, there's sand in there versus rocks. And it's ultra high performance because it can get to compressive strength of 14,000 pounds per square inch in 4 to 5 days.
Okay.
And it actually flows like liquid when you move it, and then it cures. So it's a, you know, it looks like, you know, from the chemical engineering background, it's thixotropic. That's the behavior of the material. So it's a really weird material. It's flexible. And that's why it's like steel, because at least for bridge construction, you put steel fibers in it. So it actually can flex, and it actually sticks to anything when it's liquid form. And my husband's material, Steel-like UHPC, is white. So it's reflective and you can color it any color you'd like. So it's a very specialized concrete, very expensive, not something that you use for to construct an entire bridge, more for connections between precast girders in a bridge, for example, or as an overlay, like a skin, mm-hmm. to basically for impact resistance and also to provide some level of ductility and resistance.
So, what is the labor involvement in the process? Because that becomes a bit of an interesting aspect given movement toward AI and what can you do in the manufacture of it where you don't need people, right? As so much of what's going on today is AI oriented, if you will. That's where the conversation is. And given the other conversation about, we're trying to create more jobs in the United States, but at the same time, we're losing jobs to AI. So where's that balance, or what does that mix with your company?
Well, in terms of the product itself, it's quite human intensive, right? So it's basically batched as a dry mix. Basically, our stuff is pre-packaged, pre-blended, and it shows up on a bridge as a dry mix. And then water needs to be added, and it's actually a add water formulation. So you basically add water in a very specific way. There's intellectual property involved because we mix in a ready mix truck. So, we can mix, 2 to 7 cubic yards in a ready mix truck in one batch, right? So all that is manual. You really can't use AI to virtually, mix this stuff, because it's just like cooking. Are you able to, maybe you can cook in the future. Maybe you can have a robot, like the Jetsons, to cook, but we're not there yet. Right. And there's a lot of art versus just a recipe. You have to kind of, there's an ambient temperature issue. There's, what's the humidity? Is it cloudy? Is it sunny? There's a lot of permutations that you do need to consider as you are mixing this stuff. And then it's poured by the contractor or placed where it's supposed to go. And that's very manual as well. However, in terms of AI, we are a startup. We operate on a very limited budget with very limited resources, and we, strive on efficiency. We're 100% virtual as a company, other than our warehouse, which is, a physical place. But a lot of that, what we do, we must rely on a collaboration and AI to actually get us, there efficiently. And so I have actually, within the firewall of Microsoft, started encouraging my staff to use Copilot within the firewall. We have to sign in and all that. So because, IP protection, trade secret, all that, it's very important that we stay within the firewall. And we do a lot of stuff relying on AI as a starting point. You don't, rely 100% on AI. You use it as a starting point to make your work more efficient. Yeah. So anything from, drafting an email to make it sound professional, to how do we, do a cost estimate on something, to what resources should we consider, as we think about, HR matters, freight matters, anything you could think of that's needed to run a business, I could start with Copilot to ask some questions to get me started and, go from there.
Well, it sounds like it's an interesting interrelationship between, the AI and the manual labor. And of course, a lot of companies are going through probably the same thing, trying to figure out, how much of this can we transfer to AI versus how much of this do we have to keep in the hands of humans, shall we say?
Absolutely.
And it's an evolving kind of decision-making thing that companies have to go through.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, I mean, I think you do need to have a level of understanding in the field, if it's a professional, you know, specialized field, to know what is about right and what is hallucination by AI or just complete garbage, right? And yeah. So I think that there's always needs to be a human intervention to make sure that you're not basically generating nonsense. So yeah. I think, you know, that's really, really, I worry about the transparency of that. You know, when I talk to my staff about how did you get here? What did you do? What questions did you ask? And, you know, show me your work. Right. Mm. That level of transparency to make sure that they're thinking appropriately and not just relying 100% on AI. And once I'm comfortable that they are, you know, exercising judgment and asking independent questions and not just accepting what's, you know, automatically generated by AI, the more, right. you know, I let go of, you know, having them work more independently. Yeah.
I think one thing that's interesting is, given that you view the company as still in a startup stage, mm-hmm. What is the ratio, shall we say? I mean, you probably have patents, but then you also mentioned trade secrets, and so at the moment, as viewed as a startup, how much of what you're doing as far as intellectual property is really still in the trade secret side, so that you're not actually giving the world information about through patents? Because
very good question.
Because patents, you're going to have to disclose what the invention is to the world, whereas yes. the trade secret, which is a different form of intellectual property, well, that's a secret. You're not telling anybody.
Absolutely. And this is something that I emphasized throughout my career, be it, you know, at the law firm when I was counseling clients, to within DuPont, to, you know, when I was even in, you know, policy discussions, and even here at the startup, you know, a patent is a piece of paper. Unless you're ready to enforce that by spending money and actually suing someone, it's a piece of paper.
Correct.
Right? Yeah. So what kind of allocation of resources are you going to, you know, set aside to actually make sure that your patent is worth anything,
right?
And it's not just allocation in the theoretical sense. You have to enforce it by monitoring the market as well. So yeah. there's that other piece on the trademark side, et cetera. So, within DuPont, there was significant allocation of resources you can imagine, right? Yeah. With a Fortune 50 company, and we had departments and everything like that. And so there was true allocation. Within, you know, a startup is very different. You know, it's got to be a thought provoking exercise, and because you can't just theoretically say, well, we will allocate it. You've got to allocate it.
Yeah.
So what we do here at Steelike is we have all forms of IP. Mm-hmm. We have patents, and I an indication or a reflection of the level of innovation we have. Okay. So it's almost like a marketing. It's almost like a marketing piece of document. Although we are willing to enforce it, you know, it is not the most critical of our IP.
Right.
We also have trademarks. The word Steelike is a registered trademark, both in the United States and the European Union, EUIPO. So we have a registered trademark. And then we have trade secrets. We have different forms of patents too. We have design patents, and we have utility patent. And you know, we also need to understand the market. The market is, if we are, you know, with a project that is sponsored, owned by a DOT, you know, bridge owner, no DOT, no state or federal government is going to allow infringement of IP, right? And so when you have a patent, you know that you're going to have your back. You know, there's an automatic enforcement there with the bridge owner not wanting to violate it, right? And that may not be the case outside of the United States, but that certainly is the case in the United States. So there's, you know, so we have those considerations as well. And we have trade secrets. And our trade secret is such that there's only two people and my husband who know the true trade secret, and the rest of the world do not know.
Right.
So, you know, all of the know-how or understanding I have formulated throughout my career enables me to form a trade secret protection plan that really maintains the trade secret as trade secret.
Yeah, and I think just what you just said for people who listen and maybe obviously aren't intellectual property lawyers and that kind of thing. I mean, it's very important to understand that, you know, for any company, when they have what they consider to be a trade secret, it literally has to be treated as a corporate secret.
Has to be.
And by telling us that only you and your husband actually have the knowledge of what the content of that secret is in fact part of what creates the trade secret, the corporate secret, which is you've got to have guidelines, corporate guidelines and rules as to who actually has access to that information. And a company should have the policies in place and enforced in order to make sure it remains a secret, right? And not exposed or disclosed to people who shouldn't know that information. And you know, lots of people get these things somewhat confused. And a trade secret versus a patent are two totally different things, because one, yes, you have to disclose lots of information in a patent. You know, the trade secret is exactly the opposite, which is no, you don't.
Yeah.
But there are guidelines, you know, certainly if you want to accuse somebody of stealing your secret, you're going to have to show that that's exactly how you treated it.
Absolutely.
And, they are fine points, and from a business perspective, some real interesting and clear distinctions that are made in this area. So.
Absolutely. And there's different levels of trade secret, right? We actually have a broader distribution of certain know-how, technology know-how that needs to happen on the bridge.
Right.
So, you know, our technicians actually hold some of our trade secret on how to mix the product on the bridge or you know, at the project site. But it still maintains its trade secret because we require that no one film the area. They're also elevated. So it's not, you know, people cannot see what is going on a ready mix truck unless they go and film it. And so we ensure that no filming is happening at that level. And, you know, our plan is to have, you know, and we actually currently have a technology transfer of those, you know, trade secrets so that we can actually scale as a company beyond where we can physically go for a project.
So,
you know, that's where know-how license, technology license, you know, can happen as a result.
Yeah. So as you've gone through this interesting voyage from being an engineer, then going to law school, and then in-house and so on, is it something that you go to places where you meet up with other CEOs that are exclusively, you know, a conference of just women who are CEOs and have a sharing of information and a career path discussion or something? Because it's very different than being the usual world of the guys, right, doing that.
You know, I wish I could say that I've gone to multiple of these. I've gone to one. and I really thoroughly enjoy that one. In the last 5 years that I've been CEO, I wish that I, you know, have an opportunity to go to additional. I think number one, I will not go to a conference where it's a cold call because I've got to know what I'm walking into, and I've got to know that it's worth my time and my company's time because we are resource challenged. The one that I did go to was referred to me by someone I trusted, and I went.
Yeah.
But you know, we're all so strong, you know, overextended that, you know, I actually don't go out looking for opportunities. I get invitations like this one, Tim, that you kindly invited me to speak, and I am more than happy to speak, but I just don't have time to actually go and look for those kinds of opportunities.
Yeah.
So really that personal connection for me, the network is really key.
Yeah.
And I would have to say in my network, there aren't that many CEOs of startups that are female that I know of.
Yeah.
And I always have to say that one instance I did go, I think we were all in the similar situation. We were all really busy. We really don't have time. So unless someone else is, you know, that we trust is organizing it, it's not going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah.
No, but it would be a wonderful thing to have. So.
Yeah. Well, I now I'm starting to feel guilty that we're taking your time away. But
No. This is a wonderful opportunity to actually reflect on, you know, where I am. And also it's an opportunity to share, because I am a sharing person. I'm not an information hold type of person. And I think especially given that we are virtual and the fact that, you know, everybody is, a lot more people are working from home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the time to allocate 4 hours, 5 hours to a conference, you know, or even go somewhere. But this I'm happy to do.
Yeah. So. Well, I guess, and you're still part of the Industry Trade Advisory Committee, correct?
I am. Yes, absolutely.
And which one are you on these days?
I am now on ITAC 9, which is the small business women and minority owned business, ITAC.
And
I actually was elected or designated by the committee to also represent the committee as an observer to the IP ITAC that you chaired for so many years capably. So
you're still then you're still having the meetings with the Department of Commerce, and I'm assuming USTR is still also part of that committee as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, different parts of USTR.
Yes, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, and commerce. Absolutely.
So, you know, for Pete, you know, again, here's another aspect of what some people do that is not known very widely outside maybe the world of Washington, D.C., which is that there are all the, and as Chen just said, it's ITAC 9 versus ITAC, I can't remember, was it 14?
14, I think. It was 13 for a while.
But these are all these different committees that are all these committees are actually made up of private sector people, whether they're corporate, legal, trade associations, whatever. And these are people that come in and actually try to advise the government about trade policy or whatever that committee's responsibility is, about how to go about interacting with our trading partners and so on. And it's not certainly not limited to those of us who live in the Washington, D.C. area. I mean, these committees are made up of people who can come in from any part of the country as long as their companies are American companies or their organizations are American organizations. So it really is something where across the country, people who have an interest in particular subject areas can find out ways to influence or try to influence or at least have a say or give their opinion about the direction of policy in this particular area. And that's why there's a whole series of these committees. And by the way, you know, what we're talking about are the committees that simply advise the Department of Commerce. Other agencies are in the government have their own system of committees. And so what we're talking about is simply this one system that deals with commerce and the U.S. Trade Rep's office. But I think this is, again, another aspect of where the ability of, you know, private sector people, regardless of what they do, have a potential of providing input. You know, it's, and this is, I guess, my little pet peeve about, oh, we have no say. You know, a lot of people just feel like they've never got a say. Well, sometimes you have to go looking for the ways to have your say.
Absolutely,
this is just one of those things. I mean, granted, we have the benefit of being here in the DC area and having interaction with government agencies and people we know. And so, yes, we have maybe an increased opportunity to get on these committees, but maybe it's a problem whereby, first of all, the government itself doesn't really do a whole lot to publicize the fact that people can get on committees like this. And maybe that's part of the problem is how do you know that these committees even exist, right?
Yeah, different agencies have different types of advisory committees. Yeah. The USPTO has, you know, two advisory committees. And, you know, it's a pretty extensive process to be accepted because you have to apply. And you have, at least with the U.S., the ITAC that we were in, it has to be sponsored by an employer. There's quite a number of, you know, various requirements. But I think it was been a worthwhile time. I do, you know, in addition to ITAC, I'm on the board of the National Inventors Hall of Fame because I truly believe in innovation and education. So, you know, my goal really is to give back as much as possible, even though I am, you know, still in a startup mode with this company. We have reached, you know, our 5-year mark. So, you know, there's data showing that, you know, it's hard the first 5 years for a startup, you know, just like with restaurants, I think it's first 18 months or something like that. But it's been, you know, I find that I guess I've been on some form of ITAC now for at least 7 years, not as long as you, Tim, but, really gained a perspective on how I can be more efficient in providing input.
Yeah, I think when I hit 20 years of being on the ITAC, I finally decided that that had been long enough. So that was good. Actually, it was felt kind of good to leave it only because at that point, it seemed to be the oldest guy in the room. So,
you were reminding the USTR of what they've done in years past.
No, unfortunately, it goes on, falls on deaf ears, unfortunately, when you do that, because you're trying to take work away from them, even though they're overworked. They don't want to hear that necessarily. But so that's when you start to think maybe it's time to move on to something else. So,
well, I appreciated your leadership. I thought your agendas were all very thoughtful and really brought things. And you were also, as chair, you were very receptive to agenda suggestions. And those were all just very good, you know, indicators of a good leadership. So I appreciate
that. Thank you. I don't know if there are other things that you want to cover just in general, because this discussion has been a little bit different from several of the other ones, because I think here, you know, talking about the perspective, your perspective and other women who may get into these corporate leadership roles, not just being, you know, we've talked to lawyers, but this is where you're mixing different backgrounds to actually be a CEO and how all those other experiences come into play that help you do what you do and what you have to do. So I think it's a very interesting conversation and approach and what you've had to say about being in the situation and the position you're in. So it's really enlightening in that sense. But I am going to say that I am going to still try and get more of your time down the road. If I have another manuscript that needs to be read.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, I'm here for you.
So that may still happen, even though I know you're telling me how busy you are, but we'll try and...
I always make time. I try at least, you know, I do my best. Sometimes I fail, but, you know, the intent is there. The desire is there.
And I appreciate it very much. It brings a little more of that reality and believability to the whole thing. So that's always an aspect that's really important. So, but we'll have to keep having these exchanges and discussions. I think, we're getting close to the hour, so I don't want to keep you too long, but appreciate all the information you've provided and your willingness to share your insight into, you know, the experiences you've had. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for this opportunity again. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, let's keep talking.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Thank you, Chin. I'm so excited to promote the work you're doing on Incandescent Women magazine as well. We're one big family here where we just cross promote and share brilliant ideas, brilliant people. Thank you, Tim. You are listening to Tim's Travails on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV. And we're also on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts. So Tim is doing amazing with his book. He has risen up and won a bunch of awards, and we're so honored. So check him out, timothytrainer.com. And we can't wait to promote again what you're doing, Chin. So thank you all for listening. Happy holidays, and we will see you all next year.